Good evening. If you have your Bible or New Testament with you, would you take it out, please, and turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. And we will read verses 26 and 27 here in just a moment. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 and 27. If you don't have a Bible with you, there should be one provided for you there in the pew, a little red pew Bible. And you should find this opening, Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 26, on page 1148. So 1148 in your pew Bible. And then Ephesians chapter 4, and we'll read verses 26 and 27 here in just a second. When I was 19 years old, I was the victim of a road rage incident at the hand of an elderly woman in a Cadillac. Now, that sounds like the beginning of a stand-up routine or something, but it really actually happened. I was pulling out of the dorm and making a left on a road that kind of was on a curve, and so I pull out and I see this Cadillac come right as I'm pulling out. I mean, we've all been in that situation, right? No ill intent. I was looking, so on and so forth. So I kind of gun it to try and get out of their way, and I do that thing that you do where you wave at them saying, sorry about that. Well, this Cadillac just gets right on my bumper. And so we go for a little ways, and then there's a stoplight. And so I pull up to the stoplight, and I'm going to go straight, and this Cadillac pulls into the turn lane on the left-hand side. And so I turn, and there's this woman sitting there, and she looked like she was 180 years old. But she was probably only half that old. And so I see this woman, and so I kind of roll down my window and I say out there, sorry. And the look on her face, she was just livid at what I had done to her, how I had inconvenienced her. And so her hand slowly raises up and she gives me an obscene gesture. And I did the only thing a reasonable person would do in that scenario. I laughed and laughed. I laughed so hard I thought I was going to start crying. And I think that lady was about to get out of the car and come after me when the light turned green. And I'm so grateful she didn't have a gun because I'm pretty sure she would have shot me. Uncontrolled anger makes us do all sorts of silly things, foolish things that we would not otherwise do. And no matter our age, if we allow anger to control us, it will cause us to do things that we would never do otherwise. Anger, white-hot anger, is a natural reaction for some of us. And I suspect there are only a minority of people here who can really and truly relate to what I feel and what others of you feel sometimes, that bubbling in your chest where you just want to rip somebody's head off. Others think, oh, well, everybody gets mad now and then. You just kind of need to get over it. But for some of us, this is the temptation, the thing that honestly might keep us out of heaven. And it can be a daily struggle. And I'm preaching on this, though, yes, I've preached on it in the past, because I continue to get questions about this subject. How do I deal with this emotion? How do I deal with these reactions? And in part, maybe, because I've tried to be honest with you in regard to my struggle in this, I get more questions about this than almost any other subject from Christians. I am endeavoring, with God's help, to train myself to feel righteous indignation against injustice instead of a petty temper tantrum against a perceived personal slight. And then to control myself, even when that anger does arise. To be angry and sin not. As Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 and 27 says, describing this transformation that takes place in the Christian, Paul says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. I've changed a lot of things about this lesson from the last time that I preached it, but that outline remains the same. Three things this evening. Number one, be angry. Number two, and do not sin. Number three, do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath. May I suggest this evening that we need to be angry, that we need to get angry about the right things. And though some suggest that anger itself is sinful, that's not what I see in the biblical text. Anger itself, that emotion, is not a sin. Now, let me temper that by saying that the vast majority of the passages on our anger as human beings, are negative in nature. So it is dangerous. Dangerous. But not all of the passages in the Bible are negative when it comes to the reaction of anger, the feeling of anger. In fact, there are instances where anger is the appropriate, the godly response. There are over 100 passages in the Old and New Testaments that talk about the anger or wrath of God. And I would be willing to bet that every single one of those instances find a situation where anger is the appropriate response. And anyone who's been in a position of leadership, a parent, a boss, a teacher, others in positions of authority, know that controlled anger can be necessary to produce results when gentler methods have been ignored. In the Old Testament, we see Moses getting angry. Yes, anger in part is what led to his downfall, but we also see him getting angry about things he should be angry about. We see the judges getting angry. We see the prophets getting angry. And most often, God Himself, filled with righteous indignation against wrongdoing. You read through the Bible in a year, as we're doing now, and over and over and over we see the anger and wrath of God displayed. As it's described in one place in the prophets, He gave full vent to His wrath and poured out His hot anger. We see the same thing in the New Testament, that God Himself is angry. Jesus, God in the flesh, in Mark chapter 3. If you turn over there with me. Mark chapter 3. Beginning in verse 1. Mark chapter 3 and verse 1. And He, meaning Jesus, entered the synagogue again. And a man was there who had a withered hand. So they watched Him closely, whether He would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse Him. That literally means bring charges against Him, right? They wanted Him to be guilty of working on the Sabbath so that they could then accuse Him of being someone who is violating the law of Moses. So their motives clearly are not just. They have no concern for this man with the withered hand. And so He said to the man who had the withered hand in verse 3, step forward. And He said to them, He puts their feet to the fire, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do evil, to save life or to kill? But they kept silent. They wouldn't even enter into a discussion with Him about what one was supposed to do on the Sabbath. And in verse 5, and He, when He had looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, He said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against Him how they might destroy Him. What was at play here? What was it that made Jesus so angry? Their wickedness, their hard-heartedness, the injustice of the whole situation, that they would pull an animal out of the ditch on the Sabbath, but they wouldn't allow Him to heal on the Sabbath. Their selfishness in thinking only of themselves, not of God, not of this man. Their oppression of this man. Their hypocrisy. Their cowardice in refusing to even answer His question. All of these things should anger us too. We need righteous indignation in our lives as Christians. I fear sometimes we aren't zealous enough about the things of God, as we discussed in Bible class this morning. I want us to think for just a moment about what makes God angry. I tried to go through the entire Bible and look at every passage that specifically talks about God's anger or wrath and what it was that made God angry. So I've compiled this list. What does God get angry about? Well, He gets angry about oppression of the poor, especially if it's by the rich, the powerful, those who are supposed to be leaders of the poor. God gets angry about complaining and murmuring from His people whom He has abundantly blessed. He gets angry about ingratitude, rebellion against His will. Adultery and fornication make God angry, as does idolatry over and over and over again. Disbelief or lack of faith in the face of overwhelming evidence where one should believe and should have no choice but believe, but choose instead to doubt. Stubbornness and hardness of heart. Habitual, intentional disobedience makes God angry. Despising God's Word and God's will that is supposed to be for our good. Irreverence or a lack of fear of God. All ungodliness and unrighteousness. Suppression of the truth of God where it cannot be heard by people. Sexual immorality, impurity, covetousness, foolish talking, crude joking make God angry. Presumptive sin that seeks to take advantage of God's grace makes God angry, as does hypocrisy and cowardice. Lust and evil desire makes God angry. So here's my very simple question. Do those things make us angry? When we see them in others, but even more importantly, when we see those things in ourselves. Are we upset about that? Are we angry about that? The seventh Psalm in verse 11 says, God is a just judge and God is angry with the wicked every day. God is angry every day. God's anger toward these things does not dull because of exposure to them. Though He has seen these things since sin came upon the earth, His anger burns as bright toward sin now as it ever has. And mere exposure to these things. If you think about it in those terms, God is exposed to more sin, sees more sin than anyone else. God sees everything that takes place here on earth. And not just the things that take place. He knows what happens in the mind, in the heart of every single individual. God sees all of those things, and yet still, sin hurts Him, sin upsets Him, sin angers Him as much now as it ever has. And if the world were to continue for another 100 million years, put any number on it that you want, God's hatred and anger towards sin would not dull. But maybe sin doesn't bother us enough. Maybe we are complacent toward it or even complicit in the sin of others. It's interesting, after Stephanie and I went to camp to be counselors up there, here you have this week of Bible study, right? And there's all these young people who are trying to do what's right. And even the ones who aren't trying to do what's right mostly fake it for that week if they're there, right? There are rules put in place to remove many of the temptations to sin. One example is modesty, right? There are certain rules in place to make sure everybody dresses in a modest way. Well, after a week of that, it's quite a shock to come back into the real world. It's quite a shock that on the way home we stop and we go into a restaurant and the first time you see a woman immodestly dressed, it's quite a shock to you. Now, on a day-to-day basis, we go to Walmart, the grocery store, we go out to eat, and that's just what we see, wave after wave after wave of that. But after having not seen it, it's kind of upsetting. And all of a sudden, I was mad about it. Why does it have to be this way? Where, in this case, a young lady, probably still in high school, where is her father? Who would allow their daughter to dress like this, knowing the way some men will look at her? And what kind of a culture tells women that nakedness empowers them instead of the reality that it turns them into objects to be used by others? And for the first time in a long time, I was mad about immodesty. Not just with Christians who ought to know better, but in general, that this sin is here and that it takes the life of young women, it takes the life of young men, maybe not in a literal sense, but in a spiritual sense. And sometimes we're so callous to it, it seems like it's not a big deal. Sin is worth getting mad about it. But implied in that statement is that there are some things that are not worth getting mad about. Sometimes we get that reversed. I would suggest that a big part of the problem with the world today is that we don't get angry enough about the things that we should, like sin, and we get too angry about things that don't really matter at all. I think we all probably have someone in our life who just has a super long fuse. You know that person? Maybe it was a grandmother or a grandfather. Maybe it was somebody else in your life. Maybe a spouse. Maybe it was somebody that you know here at church. And you see that person and it just seems like it doesn't matter what happens to them, doesn't matter what somebody else says, doesn't matter what they go through, they just don't lose their temper, right? How effective is it with that person when they do get angry and express that anger? It is super effective, right? And there's a lesson to be learned there for us, parents and grandparents and spouses especially. We don't need to be angry all the time. This is something that needs to be used sparingly. And if we do, if we get angry about the right things, and it is clear that these are the only things that we really get angry about, then it will be an effective tool in our toolbox to make a point. If we let it get out of hand and any little thing makes us fly off the handle, it will destroy everything in its path, including us. And it's not just the things that we get mad about, but the motivation for that anger is just as important as the object. Injustice. Is injustice something that we should get mad about? Let me hear your heads rattle. Yes or no? Should we get mad about injustice? I think we should. But what object of injustice do we really get mad about? When it's me, right? When it's injustice toward me, that's when we get upset. When I was up visiting my parents the last time, my dad threw me the keys and asked me to drive to Tyler where we were going to go out to eat. And then it was Wednesday night, so we were going to go to Bible study. Just my dad and I, we had a great time, a great trip. So I'm driving toward Tyler. I've got my cruise set just on the speed limit. We're talking and having a good time. And we haven't even really hit the city yet. I suppose we were within the city limits. But I see lights go on and I pull over. And apparently the speed limit had dropped 15 miles an hour, and I didn't even get a chance to say anything. Was I guilty? Sure. But that's unjust, right? Like, it's so aggravating. Well, why am I upset about that? Because it was me, and because now I have to pay a ticket, right? And you call, and you can't even talk to the judge or anything, and I'm not going to drive up to Tyler, and that's another story. But what about injustice toward others? Isn't that a relatively small thing in the grand scheme of everything? What about injustice toward the innocent? Am I still angry about that? I think the great sin of our nation is abortion. Here we are, a so-called Christian nation founded on so-called Christian principles. And yet there has been a Holocaust unlike anything the world has seen before. Are we mad about that? Or is that something that has just become a part of the fabric of the culture to the point we don't even think about it? Well, what if I am mad about it? Well, it's not enough just to be mad. That needs to motivate me to do something. Righteous indignation should cause me to take action. I need to be praying about it. praying to the Lord of heaven and earth that something can be done and that He might open doors of opportunity for me to stem the tide in whatever small way I might be able to. For my family and I, we contribute to various organizations who aid in adoption to try and give another option to those who might go down that path. We need to be ready to provide support for those that we may know who come into that situation. I need to preach on it as a preacher. I have this pulpit, in a literal sense, right? And for me personally, I refuse to vote for a political candidate who is pro-killing babies. That's where I draw the line. And there might come a time in this country where I'm just unable to vote, but that's the reality of the matter for me. There are some things that we just need to be mad about. We need to be angry about. But we all must learn that there are some things that aren't worth being angry about. What things did you get mad about when you were three? I have a three-year-old, so I know all about that, right? What things did you get mad about when you were five or six? What things did you get mad about when you were 14? When you were 20 or 30 or 70? The things we get mad about change or should change, right? If someone takes my juice cup at supper here in a little bit, I'm not going to hit them, right? They can have it. That's natural maturity that will come for all of us. But spiritual maturity says that if this thing doesn't have eternal significance, I don't need to really get that angry about it. Now, I think we have to learn to differentiate between that feeling that rises up in our chest to a certain degree. We can't control that. But I need to be reasonable enough to know that there are some things that aren't worthy of being angry about, no matter what my initial feeling might be. And as we grow in our spirituality, may I suggest that we should get angry about nobler and nobler and nobler things. And we should have nobler and nobler motives in those things that we get angry about. But even if we are getting angry about the right things, the devil can still use that as an opportunity to get us to sin if we respond to those things in the wrong way. When someone teaches false doctrine, that should upset us. That should anger us. But how do we respond to that? How do we respond to that with our friends, with our family, with our classmates? Well, we need to have righteous indignation, but we do not need to allow this to cause an outburst of wrath that in and of itself is sinful. We need to be angry, but do not sin. We need to control our anger instead of letting it control us. We need to learn how to be angry but not allow that anger to lead to sin. A great example of this is found in Genesis chapter 4. If you turn over there with me, please. Genesis chapter 4. Let's begin reading in verse 2. Adam and Eve have two sons, Cain and Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord accepted Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." Anger gives the opportunity to sin. It gives place to the devil, as Ephesians 4:27 says. We don't need to give the devil this opportunity. We don't need to open the door even a crack, because he's going to bust right through if we allow him. It is kind of like a weakened immune system, right? Where we are more susceptible to whatever infection or disease might come along. So we have to be even more vigilant, more careful. And we need to rule over this sin instead of allowing it to rule over us. Well, what does that look like practically? I want you to turn to James chapter 1 and verse 19. If you're in a pew Bible, that's on page 1184. James chapter 1 and verse 19 and 20. Let's actually begin in verse 13. James chapter 1 and verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Now, the desire takes place when that feeling wells up in us and we want to do or say something that we ought not do or say. And we have the opportunity to do or say something that we ought not do or say. But to this point, we've only been tempted. We haven't sinned. Verse 15, then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. We're preeminent over the rest of creation. And God has brought us forth in his image, and he gives us good gifts. I think primarily he's talking about the Word of God, but may I suggest that even this emotion can be a good gift from God if we use it in the proper way. Verse 19, so then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. We know that nothing productive or godly comes of these outbursts of wrath. It's one of the works of the flesh in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20. This wrath or outburst is what we have to guard against in the heat of the moment. Later on, I can deal with overcoming the anger. Right now, I need to keep myself from sinning. And we sin when we lose control, when we don't rule over our temper. So how do I control my temper like I should? Notice a few things from this text. Number one, we need to remember the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. To put it another way, we need to be constantly seeking to produce God's righteousness. That needs to be the goal in our lives. That's one of the points that Harold made this morning about the righteousness of God. And the way we do that is by asking ourselves, what is the spiritual reaction? When I am in this situation where I might lose my temper, will losing my temper draw the person closer to Christ? Will it glorify God? Will it produce righteousness in my life if I have an outburst of wrath? And this is something that we need to be thinking about beforehand, because in the moment, it's going to be difficult to slow down and say, okay, let me just go through all of the scenarios here. May I suggest that the more spiritual we are, the less inclined we will be to allow anger to bear unrighteous fruit. Prayer and study and good works, a selfless love for all men, preparing ahead of time, will leave anger with very little fuel left to burn. But the more carnal we are in other areas, the more likely carnality will win out in our anger too. I think one of the most difficult things about anger is that we have to swallow our pride a lot of times in order to control our temper. When we're embarrassed, and that makes us angry. When we've been shown up, and that makes us angry. When someone challenges us in some way, and that makes us angry. To control our temper is not the weak response. It is the meek response. That I have the power to reply in whatever way I choose, but I'm going to choose to reply with godliness, with righteousness. And I don't want to hear the excuse, well, I can't control it. I can't help it. I just react. Believe me, brother or sister, I have been there. And we need to get beyond that kind of thinking. That is from the devil to try and give us an excuse to act in whatever way we want. And when that really clicked for me, I'm sad to admit, it really wasn't until I started preaching. Maybe if we're going to lose something important to us, we can control our temper more than we act like we can. Just after I'd started preaching, I had a really sweet golf situation. My uncle is a member of a club nearby where I was preaching. And in the evenings, I was able to get on and walk that course for less than $10. I mean, it was a fabulous golf course, and I was able to walk for less than $10. But being the private club that it was, there were a lot of restrictions on what you could do and couldn't do, what you could wear and what you couldn't wear. And maybe the second or third time that I'd done this, gone out late in the evenings, I was carrying my bag, and I come up to my ball on the very first hole. I put my clubs down, and I get a club out to hit my next shot, and there's this cart coming to me, and it's the marshal. So there's marshals on a lot of golf courses that go around to make sure everybody's doing what they are supposed to be doing. And so I said, "Hi, sir, how you doing this afternoon?" And he told me to tuck in my shirt in the most profane way I could certainly think of. He didn't say hi. He didn't say how you were doing. He just told me to tuck in my shirt. I was holding a golf club when he did this. He was taking his life into his own hands. But not only did I not hit him with the golf club, I also didn't reply in anger. I said, "Yes, sir. I'll be sure and do that right away." It was tough. I was shaking so bad, I double bogeyed the next two holes. But as I got to thinking about that, I realized that one of the big reasons why I didn't respond as I ordinarily would have under different circumstances is because I had a pretty sweet gig there lined up at that golf course, and I didn't want to ruin it. Maybe if something's really important to us, we can control ourselves better than we act like we can. That's how important God should be to us. Not as important as a golf course, but so important to us that we're going to control ourselves. Because the wrath of man, my wrath, allowing that to boil over in an uncontrolled sort of way is never going to produce the righteousness of God. It is never going to produce what it ought to produce in my life or the lives of others. And if God and spiritual things are really that important to me, and if I determine that beforehand, I believe that God will help us to have the control that we ought to have. We need to remember that the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And as the text in James 1 says, we need to be swift to hear. We need to hear out what they're saying. Did you understand them correctly? Do they have a good point and you're just mad because it's true? So often before our spouse or our parents or our employee or our boss or our friend or whatever the case might be, before they even really get started good, we're already mad. We're already angry to the point that we're not even listening to what it is that they're saying. And so we put the absolute worst construction on it, we cut them off, and we reply instead of trying to listen to what it is they're saying. Especially as it pertains to our brethren, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 7 says, "Love believes all things." And that means that we put the best construction on things. If we love that person, and we should, we're going to put the best construction on it. And instead of jumping right back in, where I want to defend myself because I'm mad, I want to fight back, I need to take the time to listen and not respond until that person is through. I'm doing so well. God help me, I'm doing so well on this in my life right now. But may I suggest that this is the biggest thing I still have to work on? That I want to just reply. Because they're wrong and I'm right. And what we need instead is to be swift to hear. hear them out, and then be slow to speak. That means taking the time to stop and think about what they've said and what you're going to say. Psalm 4 and verse 4 says, "Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still." Sometimes that's what we need before we say anything. We studied this morning in the Bible class from John chapter 2, verses 13 through 17, where Jesus was driving out the money changers in the temple. And I think there is no doubt that Jesus was angry on that occasion. But did he just fly off the handle? What did he do first? He sat down and he braided a whip. I don't know how long that took. But a whip big enough and strong enough in order to drive out these livestock would have taken some time, right? Some people suggest that you need to count. Maybe that works for you. I've suggested before that that has never worked for me. But what has worked for me is saying a quick prayer. Lord, help me to control my temper. Help me to respond the way I should. What has helped me is to recite a quick verse. In fact, this very verse from James chapter 1, "Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." I say that in my own head so that I might slow down. And may I also suggest that if we know that there are going to be situations where I'm tempted to be angry and have wrath, to lose my temper, I need to pray beforehand. I had a young man come to me not too long ago, and he was really struggling with his temper. And I said, "Okay, give me some situations where you're really struggling." He says, "In my commute, every day when I go home, it seems like every time I'm losing my temper and I'm honking at people and I'm saying things that I shouldn't and all these sorts of things." I said, well, what do you do before you get in the car? What do you do before you drive off? He said, "I don't know. I just get in the car and drive off." I said, "I want you to set a timer. And I want you to set it for 5 minutes. And all this week, I want you to pray for your commute home that you would act like a Christian." End of the week, he came to me and said, "We got that commute figured out." That's simple. Simple, isn't it? If we will take the time to make spiritual things a priority, to stop and think before we speak, before we act. And then if we do speak, to choose our words very wisely. Sinful anger usually manifests itself in the things that we say. James chapter 3 talks about the power of the tongue and the destructive power of the tongue. And I'll admit to you, when I'm angry, I have such clarity of mind and tongue that I can say exactly what I want to say when I'm angry. I don't ever necessarily know what's going to come out of my mouth, but I know that it's going to be just the right, hurtful, biting thing if that's the path I choose to go down. Instead, what I need to do is know exactly what I'm going to say and then say it in a measured and careful way. Proverbs chapter 15 speaks to this idea. Proverbs chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. "A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger." Now, we know that's not true 100% of the time, but this is generally the case. If we answer in a soft and loving way, it's not going to escalate the situation. "The tongue of the wise uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness." Now, a lot of the people that we're angry with, our family, for instance, we have great knowledge about that person. How are we going to use that knowledge? Sometimes we use it to say the exact thing that is going to be the most biting, the most insulting, the most hurtful. That is just a fool pouring forth foolishness. Instead, we need to stop and think and choose our words wisely. We need to be slow to wrath as Christians. We should try and develop a long fuse. And this is the exact concept of long suffering that we see throughout the Bible. As Proverbs 14 and verse 29 says, "Whoever is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who has a hasty temper exalts folly." Now we know that God is angry about sin all the time, but another descriptor of God that we see throughout the Bible is that He is slow to anger, that God is long-suffering toward us. And we too need to be long-suffering. We don't need to fly off the handle at the slightest provocation. And in the end, it's not just a matter of getting anger out of our lives. We have to replace it with some sort of godliness, which means that we need to be willing to forgive. It's not enough to get the bad out. We need to bring some good in. And in going back to Ephesians chapter 4, we see what it is that we're supposed to replace with what we're supposed to replace this anger. If you notice, especially in Ephesians chapter 4, in verse 31 and 32, the same concept of putting off the old man, being renewed in the spirit of our mind, and putting on the new man. He says, "Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." Those are all ungodly outlets of anger. But instead, verse 32, "Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you." We usually think of doing something to get the anger out. We need to, wash dishes or work in the yard or go on a run or whatever the case might be. And that might be helpful. But if we don't replace the anger with something positive, it will keep coming back. What we need to replace it with is kindness and tenderheartedness and a willingness to forgive as Christ has forgiven us. And then finally, we need to make sure that we do not let the sun go down on our wrath. We need to resolve anger to keep it from turning into bitterness, because that's the progression. Anger and then an outburst of wrath, and if it's unchecked, it will develop into bitterness. That's exactly what Hebrews chapter 12, verses 14 and 15 suggest. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 14, "Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord." Verse 15, "Looking carefully, lest anyone falls short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness spring up and cause trouble, and by this many become defiled." So if we have this unresolved conflict, a lack of peace with people, then the root of bitterness will spring up if we are not careful. If we have been wronged or think we, if we have wronged or think we have been wronged, this bitterness can become a consuming poison for us. I know of an instance where a brother had resentment in his heart toward another brother for 25 years. He finally went and talked to him about it, and the other brother didn't even know it. Didn't even know there was conflict there. It had poisoned their relationship for over 2 decades, and it was never even dealt with. And you know the ironic thing? It turned out to all be a misunderstanding. 25 years, this bitterness had had a seed in his heart because he had not resolved the conflict. We need to make sure that we are resolving the conflict. Don't let the sun go down on our wrath. Matthew chapter 5 talks about how we should be running into each other to make sure that we're taking care of these conflicts that we have. And I think all of this points us to the undeniable fact that you can control yourself. I can control myself. You can control yourself. But a man without self-control, Proverbs 25 and 28, is like a city broken into and left without walls. Don't let it stew and fester. Take care of it as best you can, and then let it go. This I know. This I know about anger. That God promises us in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 that we will not be tempted beyond that which we are able to bear. But with the temptation, God will make a way of escape. And every time I think I'm almost there with this temptation, my foot almost slips. I snap at Steph or the kids, and I think to myself, what is wrong with me? But I'm reminded of the grace of God. which can overcome this or any sin. God doesn't make it magically go away, not the temptation. Instead, He gives us the wisdom to deal with it in a godly way. And He provides a way for us to escape all sin through Jesus Christ our Lord. If you're not yet a Christian this evening, you may be able to control your anger to a certain degree, but you are still lost in your sins. And it's our prayer and our hope that you would come to Jesus Christ even this evening to find real and lasting forgiveness. Won't you come while together we stand and while we sing?